You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
We dedicate this reading to Nelson Rodriguez and Bob Everton, and also to Waldo Briño, a comrade in struggle, a Chilean, a friend, who is now literally fighting for his life in the palliative care unit of VGH. This is for Waldo. Also to Salvador Allende, Victor Jara, Miguel Enriquez, Lumi Videla, Freddy Taberna, Carmen Bueno, Juan Ibarra, Fernando Kraus, René Barrientos, María Verónica Cienfuegos, Arcadia Flores, Cecilia Magni, Luz Painemán, Nilda Peña, Ana María Puga, Patricia Quiroz, and all of those that were murdered and disappeared by the dictatorship.
So I'm Carmen's daughter, also called Carmen. I'm going to read a little bit from my book, Something Fierce, Memoirs of a Revolutionary Daughter. The part that I'm going to read from actually takes place, the part that I'm reading from is in La Paz, Bolivia, in 1979. And it's on the day of another coup, the Natush Bush coup in Bolivia in 1979. So that occurred when I was 12 years old. And when my mother, her partner at the time, Bob Everton, my sister and I were in Bolivia running a safe house for Chilean resistance members who were going in and out of Chile in response to the return plan. The return plan being a call that the Chilean resistance made to exiles all over the world to return to Chile and or its neighboring countries and join the underground to fight against the dictatorship. So this part that I'm going to read, which is on the day of the coup in Bolivia, we are actually hiding two people in the house, two people who were, let's say they were on the most wanted list in Chile at that time. So that's what I'm going to read from. On the morning of the coup in Chile, my mother and father had called Ale and me into their bed. Together, we'd listened to President Allende say goodbye over the radio as warplanes flew above La Moneda Palace. Compañeros, surely this will be the last opportunity for me to address you. My words do not express bitterness, but disappointment. May there be a moral punishment for those who have betrayed their oath, the soldiers of Chile. The only thing left for me to say is to the workers, I am not going to resign. Placed in a historic transition, I will pay for your loyalty with my life. And I say to you that the seeds we have planted in the good conscience of thousands and thousands of Chileans will not be shriveled forever. Social processes can be arrested by neither crime nor force. History is ours. And people make history. Workers of my country, I want to thank you for the loyalty you always had, the confidence that you deposited in a man who was only an interpreter of great yearnings for justice. At this definitive moment, the last moment when I can address you, I wish you to take advantage of the lesson. Foreign capital, imperialism, together with the reactionary right, created the climate in which the armed forces broke their tradition. I address the youth, those who sang and gave us their joy and their spirit of struggle. I address the worker, the farmer, the intellectual, those who will be persecuted, because in our country, fascism has already been present for many hours. History will judge them. There had been a whistling, then the sound of bombs exploding. My parents, who had joined the student movement in the 60s, had sobbed quietly as they held us. And when we tried to speak, they pressed a finger to their pursed lips and whispered, "Listen, Compañero Allende has something important to say, and no matter what happens to us, you must always remember this moment." And so we sat and listened. I will always be next to you. At least my memory will be that of a man of dignity who was loyal to his country. The people must defend themselves. They must not let themselves be destroyed or riddled with bullets, but they cannot be humiliated either. Workers of my country, I have faith in Chile and its destiny. Other men will overcome this dark and bitter moment when treason seeks to prevail. Go forward knowing that, sooner rather than later, the great avenues will open once again, where free men will walk to construct a better society. Viva Chile. Viva el pueblo. Vivan los trabajadores. These are my final words, and I am certain that my sacrifice will not be in vain. I am certain that at the very least, it will be a moral lesson that will punish felony, cowardice, and treason. That voice and its message had been burned into my core forever. We'd listened on that bed in our yellow wooden house in Valdivia, as if we were on a vessel lost at sea. Thank you.
As Carmencita was saying, we came to Canada as a family in 1974. And here we dedicated ourselves to create a solidarity movement towards the resistance, for the resistance movement in Chile. So some of you have already reminded me tonight about the peñas that we used to have at the Russian Hall and the Ukrainian Hall, these huge gatherings where we ate empanadas and we drank wine and we sang and we made speeches and we put everybody up to date on what was happening in Chile at the moment. But then, later on, a few years later, as Carmen was saying, we were invited, we were urged, and we were honored to be asked to go to Bolivia and support the resistance in a more direct way, which we did. So the short story that I'm going to read now is based on that experience, but because it's fiction, I have placed the protagonist in Chile. She's underground in Chile, and she's talking to her comadre, her friend, that has stayed in Vancouver. "It's true, comadre. No money for carpets here. At most, the mattress on the floor, kerosene for the hot plate, and cigarettes. Can't get along without those. It's a different life altogether, no question about that. But the difference doesn't only lie in the lack of material comfort. No, it also lies in the lack of comfort for the mind and for the stomach. But I can't complain, comadre. I don't have to be concerned with diets anymore. This lifestyle does wonders for my figure. In Vancouver, we never imagined what life underground would really be like. It's a full-time job. And I don't mean 8 hours a day, but 24. The tasks can be extremely boring, or once in a while, very dangerous. Life underground is no ball of cherries, comadre, that's for sure. And on top of everything else, you can't even talk about your past or present life with anybody. But I can talk to you, comadre, anytime and about whatever I want. All I have to do is plug you into my mind, and there we go. I can tell you things, remember things. Somehow I know that you can hear me up north. I sent you these telepathic messages, and then I feel better, relieved, lighter, happier. And here I am, comadre, Sunday in August, lying on my bed, talking to you, and listening to the Susana Rinaldi tape that you used to like so much. We listened to it together for the last time that summer afternoon in Vancouver, almost a year ago, lying on the carpet in your living room, silently, knowing that never again, never again. Malena canta el tango como ninguna y en cada verso pone su corazón. Malena sings the tango like no one else and commits her heart to every verse. My heart is committed, but I'm afraid I can't go, you said. In silence, we left the house and walked to the beach. Jericho Park bustled with people and Vancouver spread out like a vision on the other side of the bay. Comadre, I never thought I would miss Vancouver when I came back to Chile. But sometimes, particularly when fear wants to take over my body and my mind, I think of Vancouver and feel a lot better. Then I would give anything to be there again, even if it were for just a few minutes, sitting on a log on the beach, looking at the ocean, the sailboats, the city on the other side of the water with its cement and crystal monuments stretching up, their hundreds of eyes lighting up in the twilight while the sun burns the sky, Stanley Park sticking its green tongue into the inlet, the mountains, a backdrop with their woods and snow-capped peaks. That afternoon, you had $50 to make a contribution to the cause. And you went on and on about the $50 and the contribution, insisting that I needed a good-looking outfit, that I needed to think about my cover. 2 hours in the boutiques on 4th Avenue and Broadway, trying clothes on, looking at myself in the mirror, turning this way, that way. Yeah, I like it, but we have to let it out here and take the hem up. No, maybe not that one. This one, if we take it in at the top and then let it out on the hips, not too bad. It's sewn right to the edge. This one will be okay if we shorten the straps. But developed dresses don't fit under developed women. The image in the mirror, ridiculous. For the 6 foot types and the hips, me with my hippopotamus rump. Frustrated, we went back to your house, comadre, picked up the guitar and the charango and started to sing. We were so good together. From the protest songs to the sambas and the bossa novas, not to mention the boleros, plus all those songs in English we learned with the help of our friend Pat. There once was a union maid. She never was afraid of the queens and the gangs and the company things and the deputy sheriffs that made the raid. And one and two and one and two with a charanguito. Who would have ever imagined, dear Armadillo, that one day you would wake up in Canada singing English songs, you who were born in the Altiplano to sing with the wind and the llamas? Oh, I would give anything to have a charango or a guitar to accompany me in a tango or a bolero. Remember that time, comadre, when we crossed the Rockies in a blizzard in the middle of the night? Scott had lent us his VW van to travel with our singing group to Calgary and Edmonton and then on a tour of BC on our way back. But we almost stayed in the Rockies, buried in snow with the van and everything else. And the only thing that stupid René could think of saying was that the Andes were a lot taller and that blizzards there were real blizzards. But at least Pablo and Carlos sang like crazy the whole way, trying to keep our spirits up, even though it was not an easy task. Comadre, I still remember the names of all those towns we went to on our way back. In some places, the public didn't even know where Chile was, let alone what had happened there. So we talked and sang, and at the end, everybody was on their feet with their left fists up in the air singing, "Trabajadores al poder." But there was no way they could say "trabajadores." So everybody would say, "Trabajadores al poder." And even we ended up shouting, "Trabajadores al poder." We even had to learn how to pray so that we could get the Christians to support us. The first time we went to talk to a congregation in New Westminster on a gray and rainy Sunday morning, the priest all of a sudden asked us to say the Our Father in Spanish. And the two of us stood up there looking at him with our mouths open because neither one remembered the Our Father in Spanish. And then I started making everything up. "Please don't forget about us. We promise to behave and forgive our trespasses because they're very small and for a good cause. But above all, don't forget our children and give us some bread for them, please. Our hands crossed over our chests, looking down to the floor. Amen." That last afternoon of my life as an exile in Vancouver, we talked about so many things, comadre, about your childhood as the daughter of rich landowners in the Rancagua region, mine as the child of a miner and a seamstress, about how, coming from such different backgrounds, we ended up sharing the same ideals, and how destiny brought us together 10,000 kilometers from where we were born. And now we were going in different directions, me to join the underground resistance in Chile, you to continue your life as an exile in Canada. You are right to be afraid, comadre, but fear is not insurmountable, and now more than ever, there is hope. There are no words to describe you, to you, how happy I would be to hear that you have decided to come back and that maybe one day we will meet and even do some tasks together. But that summer afternoon in Vancouver, we knew that it would be a long time before we met again. And today, as I smoke my Hiltons and shiver in the Santiago winter cold, I miss you, comadre. I touch you, look at you, talk to you, hug you, just like I did so many times up there in Canada. I will never forget our trespasses, comadre, particularly those of our last afternoon together. The ocean was cold. No matter how hot it gets up north, the water is always cold. The moon started to come out and we had to get dressed because if the cops caught us stark naked on the beach. "I can't see you off, eh?" "No, comadre." "Can you write to me?" "Mm-mm." "Be careful, eh?" "Yeah, I'll be careful." "Here's the $50. They'll come in handy." "Thanks, comadre." "I'll keep doing what I can up here until I'm brave enough to go back, okay?" "Okay." Life is no tango, but shit, it sure seems like it sometimes. The last thing I saw of you, comadre, was your back and the way it carried the weight of your pain. I'm waiting. I am waiting for you.
Because it's a mother-daughter thing, I think I can actually add a couple of things to that little story she just told. The woman she's referring to was like an aunt to me, and she did end up going south. She fought in the Nicaraguan Revolution in 1979. And the $50, you will see a continuity here with what I'm going to read. So this part of the book that I'm going to read is also 1979. It's December 1979, about a month after the part that I just read. I'm still 12 years old. My sister is 10, going on 11. She's about to turn 11. And my sister and I and a woman, a Chilean resistance woman who's on the Central Committee of the Chilean Resistance, who has never returned to Chile, is returning for the first time. And my sister and I are going with her. Needless to say, this is an extremely dangerous situation. It was 6 in the morning at the La Paz train station, and already the first class section of the train heading to the border was crammed with well-dressed ladies, families from all walks of life, and the odd businessman in suit and tie, fresh newspaper in hand. Christmas was only a few days away, and many people were traveling. Bob and Mummy had instructed us on the details of the journey Ale and I would be making without them. One of our instructions was to pretend we didn't know Trinidad, who'd be accompanying us part of the way. She'd been back sleeping on our floor for the past week, acting as if she'd never left.
Check your text messages. Should I still come?
I'll just wait for that to be over.
Check your text.
Oh, it's your phone. Okay. That's okay.
I'll
just wait for that. Okay. Okay. Trinidad had been back sleeping on our floor for the past week, acting as if she'd never left. This time around, she had gotten up early every morning and readied herself to go downtown, where she was picking up some papers, she said. Her morning ritual began by taking a curling iron to her frizzy head. Once her hair was in ringlets, Trinidad would powder her face and apply red lipstick, blue eyeshadow, and mascara. Skin-tight black jeans and a red paisley shirt completed the look, with a black corduroy blazer to keep her warm in the cold highland mornings. She'd carry out her ritual while smoking one jeton after another and listening to the miners' radio on the shortwave, low, so the neighbors wouldn't hear. The four of us had taken a cab to get here. Trinidad was going to meet us on the train. Inside our brown carry-ons, stuffed with clothes, cheese rolls, and grapefruits, was a typewritten letter my mother had given us, which we were to read, memorize, then burn and flush down the toilet shortly after the train left. The $50 bill at the bottom of my bag was all the cash we had. Following Bob's lead, we were speaking English. When we arrived at our seats to see that a cholita, an urban Indian woman, had taken them over with 5 sacks of onions and 7 children, Bob shouted at her to move, waving our tickets in her face. Señora! As you can see, I have paid good money for these seats so that my daughters can travel in comfort. Who cares about your tickets, Mr. Gringo? I got here first, she responded, sitting like a large oak tree rooted to the ground. Listen, senora, don't make me call a policeman to have you forcibly removed. Just try it, the woman crossed her arms. Police! Bob yelled at the top of his lungs. The lady grabbed her onions and her children and moved, swearing under her breath. We could have shared our seats with the lady, but Bob was acting like the big city guy he'd argued with on the bus back in Peru. It was a soul-destroying tactic, But as my mother had explained, if we were to keep people safe and transport goods across borders without being caught, we had to hold our beliefs inside. I could see that it cut Bob to the quick. Trinidad arrived a few minutes later, carrying a small white Samsonite. She looked tired, maybe because she had spent a good 2 hours in the bathroom in the middle of the night. Trinidad had some health troubles because of the concentration camps, my mother told us. That's why nature rarely called. When it did, she had to heed it. Speaking in a perfect Mexican accent now, Trinidad greeted Ale and me and indicated she'd be sitting in the seat facing us. Bob made a huge show of asking her to keep an eye on his 2 daughters who were going to Chile to visit their grandparents. That part was true. Then it was time to go. Ali and I pressed our faces to the window as the train pulled out, leaving Mommy and Bob standing on the platform with tears running down their faces. Their girls were going back to the beloved country they were not allowed to enter, and that was difficult to bear. We gazed out the window in silence as the train climbed in circles up the bowl of La Paz. In the poor neighborhoods on the hills, ladies lined up with kettles at outdoor faucets and chickens scratched in the dirt. The highlands stretched all around us as the train traveled west. We read for a while, and then I nudged Ale. She hesitated for a moment before grabbing her bag and coming with me to the bathroom. I made sure the door was securely locked behind us before pulling out my copy of Mami's letter written in English. I read to Ale in a whisper, "Girls, please read this letter very carefully. I know you have memorized your instructions, but here they are anyway in writing. Your passports say you were born in Santiago, Chile. If the border guards ask you, you must tell them that you left Chile for Canada in September 1970 because your parents are in the mining sector and had some work to do with Noranda. The guards will understand this to mean that you come from a right-wing pro-Pinochet family. You will tell them that your parents are in Bolivia on business at the moment and that you are going to visit your grandparents who live in Iquique. Remember that you met Trinidad for the first time on the train. Never, ever answer any questions from a stranger and don't offer any explanations to the border guards unless asked. If Trinidad is taken away at the border, stay calm and get back on the train. Once you reach Arica, watch out for a young, well-dressed couple at the station. They will be waiting for you to approach them and will take care of you. If the couple are not there, or if you think it's not safe to approach them, use your $50 to take a taxi to the bus station and buy tickets to Santiago. Your grandmother will be waiting for you there at the station. Do not, under any circumstances, tell your grandparents about this letter. We know your first trip back from exile will be an incredible experience for you both. Keep your eyes and ears and hearts open at all times, and in that way, you will learn about life. We love you, Mommy and Bob. Ale was leaning against the wall of the tiny, disgusting bathroom, holding her nose. She didn't say a word as I rummaged through her bag, then set both copies of the letter on fire, using the lighter Bob had given me. I dropped them, still flaming, through the hole that served as a toilet onto the tracks. My hands were trembling. Ale refused to meet my gaze. You've got to make sure you remember everything in the letter, I said. I do remember it, you fool. Let's go. I made us both brush our hair before we left the bathroom. If anybody was wondering what we'd been doing in there, they'd think we'd gone to primp. Walking back to our seats with the letters gone, I felt 1,000,000 pounds lighter. Trinidad was lost in thought, watching the landscape go by and leaving red lipstick marks on her cigarette butts. She was probably steeling herself for the border crossing into Chile, which Bob had told us was 24 hours away. All I knew was that soon, very soon, I'd get to see my grandma Carmen again. 4 years earlier, my grandma and grandfather had come to Vancouver to visit us. I'd sat with Abuelita at our dining room table every afternoon while she knitted sweaters for us kids, and I savored every scrap of her news. After the coup, she and my grandfather had moved to Limache, a small town an hour inland from Valparaíso. There, my grandfather had built a yellow wooden house, and they'd succumbed to the quiet life imposed upon them now that two of their three children and half their grandchildren were exiled. As she wondered aloud how the watermelons and peaches and apricots in her orchard were coming along, my heart ached for that place I'd never seen. Their yellow house was the stuff of legend, the place we'd all go when Pinochet fell and Chile was socialist again. Ale had pulled the deck of cards from her bag and was shuffling them like an expert. Señora Zamora, do you know the game Mao Mao? She asked Trinidad. I froze because Ale had just put her foot in it. Mao Mao was a game Trinidad had taught us, and anybody in the know would recognize it as one of the games like Ho Chi Minh, You're the Bomb, and Run, Che, Run, that had been invented by political prisoners to pass the time in concentration camps. This train had to have at least one informer on it, but Trinidad simply stifled a laugh and shook her head no. As night fell, the temperature on the train dropped to freezing. People hugged their knees to their chests. It was too cold to sleep, and by morning my whole body was numb. It was almost noon when a guard yelled out, "Everybody off the train with your belongings. Stand in line for inspection." The small border station quickly filled up with passengers. Everybody stood nervously silent, the only sound an occasional baby crying. People had pulled combs through their hair and passed wet hankies over their faces. The ladies wore fresh lipstick. Border guards with machine guns walked up and down the lines. Directly above the head honcho who sat at a wooden desk hung a massive portrait of Pinochet, captioned, "The Savior of the Fatherland." Pinochet was wearing a gray cape in the photo, and his eyes followed you wherever you went. My knees started to shake. Their accents, their impeccable uniforms had brought on the terror. I'd been scared lots of times since we'd left Canada, but this was the kind of fear that felt as if a rat was walking up and down your spine, from your tailbone to the base of your skull. It was the kind of fear that gave you a sick, cold feeling in the pit of your stomach and made you sweat. Only the sweat was ice, and the ice got you trembling like a leaf in a storm. A wailing baby brought me back to the border station. I looked over at Trinidad, who was standing stock still, holding her white suitcase. The head honcho shouted at a group of Bolivians, "Indians, swine, filthy pigs. You are a disgrace to a civilized country such as ours. Step aside." A great, fury strangled me. But then I remembered. My sister and I were escorting Trinidad into Chile so she could fight for a revolution that would change all this. This was her first venture back, and Ale and I were her cover. I stood straight and still, just like her. Thank you.
This is a part of a couple of pages from my novel, in which the protagonist, Sol Martinez, goes back to Chile from Canada because the remains of his her disappeared husband, it appears that they have been found. So she goes to look for the remains, Miguel's remains. And in a way, it brings us back to the time of past dictatorship and to the time when there is already a limited democracy in Chile, as there is now. So it will bring us more to the present, and then we can open up the discussion about what's going on in Chile today as well. So this is Sol waking up in Santiago after a long, long time. Cars honk, bells ring, dogs bark, children sing. Voices offer their hellos, their goodbyes. I open my eyes and find myself in the semi-darkness of a bedroom. It takes me a moment to remember that I'm in the city of love, the city of terror. I jump out of bed and open the window. Santiago pours in like the haunting song of a mermaid. I cannot help but surrender to her appeal. How to resist the dry and warm air of this summer morning, the height of the snow-capped Andes, the aroma of the blooming honeysuckle, the luminous purple of the jacarandas. Santiago is beautiful. In my daily walks, I've been rediscovering the city's treasures, centenary buildings with red tile roofs, thick adobe walls, and interior courtyards where a grapevine twines itself around a wooden arbor, cobblestone streets bordered by gigantic sable trees, old plazas where dark-skinned children with huge rosy cheeks play ronda or swing to and fro, accompanied by giggles and squeaks. So many forgotten sounds. When I came back clandestinely in 1986, Santiago was still a whispering city, its hushed din punctured by sporadic street demonstrations against the dictatorship. Today, it has recovered its tongue. There go the organ grinders of Parque Forestal, the street vendors offering Band-Aids, chewing gum, sugar-covered berlines, sewing needles, handkerchiefs, roasted peanuts, caramel-filled barquillos, peaches, ice cream, lottery tickets, newspapers, and magazines. There goes the boom of the cannon announcing noon hour from Santa Lucia Hill. My ears have been savoring the sing-song of Chilean Spanish, its quick tempo. I haven't hesitated to follow suit, and now I can hear myself speak in my most Chilean voices to the person sitting next to me on the bus or admiring shoes in the Falabella store window on Ahumada Street. I catch myself complimenting conversations with that peculiar fluttering of hands and eyelashes, that propensity to laughter, that wanting to talk to everybody about everything all at once. In Canada, I have a foreign accent. Here, I have an accent, but it's just like everybody else's. My daughter is far away. Vancouver is far away. Commercial Drive, that's my neighborhood, the one I've come to love, I tell myself. But my body doesn't respond. What my body wants is to submerge itself in this Chileanness. It wants to eat its fill of ayuyas, avocados, lucuma ice cream, corn casserole, cazuela, cheese-filled empanadas, juicy chirimoyas and watermelon, manjar, the flavors and aromas of my childhood and youth. My body wants to convince me that I haven't changed and that the country hasn't changed. But it has changed, and I have changed. Every time I get on the modern and impeccably clean subway train, terror lodges in my throat once again as I wonder, how many of these men and women were informers, torturers, collaborators? How many made false accusations in order to save their own skin? How many covered their ears and eyes so as not to hear, not to see? How many would support the persecution and the massacre once again? But then, as I look around and attempt to see through those inscrutable faces, I also ask myself, how many of these men and women had their dreams and part of their lives amputated on September 11, 1973? How many participated in the resistance movement to the dictatorship? Who is who? So that brings us to kind of the present time, to a Chile in 2013, 40 years after the military coup, and in the middle of a campaign for an election, which is to happen in November. A Chile that is obviously completely different from the one we left in 1973, and also in many ways different from the Chile of the dictatorship, but unfortunately also in many ways very, very similar. However, some very important things have been happening in Chile in the last couple of years. It looks like that tongue, you know, that I talk about in this excerpt from the novel, that Chile seemed to start recovering in the 80s has really exploded. Street demonstrations initiated by the student movement in 2011 brought to the forefront the inadequacies of the economic model, of the political model, the injustices that are still happening. You know, we cannot forget, for example, that Chile is still being ruled by the Pinochet Constitution of 1980. So the students began the whole movement, but they have been followed by all kinds of sectors of society. And today we have all walks of life on the streets demanding better working conditions, an improved wage. Ecological issues are at the forefront of many of the fights. Healthcare, education, you name it. Everybody is out on the streets demanding rights that they have not had for many, many years. And at the same time, the country is getting prepared for an election in which there are 9 candidates. And the 2 main candidates are 2 women. That's interesting. What is even more interesting, I find, though, is that these 2 women are daughters of 2 Air Force generals. Michelle Bachelet is the daughter of Alberto Bachelet, a general of the Air Force who supported Allende. And because he supported Allende, he was tortured and he was imprisoned after the coup, and he died a few months later in prison. Evelyn Matei is the daughter of the Matei that supported the coup, a general as well, and who not only supported the coup but was part of the military junta during the 80s, was Pinochet's minister of health, and obviously at the other end of the spectrum. So here today we have in many ways this symbolic situation of 2 women, daughters of 2 generals, sitting at 2 ends of the teeter-totter. However, we have to qualify that Bachelet, even though she is center-left, she's a social democrat, and there are no huge changes that she's proposing. She's proposing a reform to the education system, a new constitution, and a reform to the tributary system. However, the neoliberal economic model that has ruled Chile since the time of the dictatorship continues to be in place, will continue to be in place, and Chile is for sale and has been for sale for decades now. Everything is privatized, and that's the struggle that the people of Chile are waging right now. The other important thing to mention is that together with this, it seems like Chile is finally recovering its memory. For decades, the country suffered from a collective amnesia. Salvador Allende, the coup, the dictatorship, what's that? You know, we don't want to talk about that. We have to look towards the future, you know. There's no need to dwell in the past. However, since the students began this movement, this incredible movement, things have been opening up. And now, in commemoration of the 40 years of the coup, there has been a program that has been shown on open television. For the first time in Chile, Chileans have been able to see the images of the brutality of the dictatorship on TV at prime time. And the program has broken all viewership's records and has gone viral on YouTube. It's called The Forbidden Images. Not only that, what the producers have done is that they've brought to the masses these images, and they have also carried out interviews with the reporters, the journalists that shot that footage, and the protagonists of the footage that managed to survive the violence. So it has made for an incredibly document that people have had access at prime time every Wednesday evening, to the extent that it surpassed the ratings of the most popular soap opera that is broadcast at the same time on a different channel. You know, the Forbidden Images has gone higher, which is really, really telling of what is happening in Chile today. So we have a convergence of factors right now that gives us hope, and that really makes us look to the past so that we can actually move forward. And finally, the other interesting thing is that there are a lot of right-wing people, characters, you know, up there. Oh, they're asking for forgiveness, and they're showing regrets because they didn't act, you know, during the dictatorship. Everybody's kind of jumping on the bandwagon of the reconciliation by just saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I didn't do more. You know, I'm so sorry that I didn't notice what was going on, etc." And I don't think Chileans will buy that kind of, I hope that they won't. So we'll see what happens on November 17th during the election.